for coming out for our final Issues in Ale of 2014. Who knew that our last event of the year we would have one of our best turnouts? So thank you all for coming. Appreciate it. Quick show of hands. How many of you have never been to an Issues in Ale event before? Wow. All right. Okay. A lot of newbies. All right. And how many of you have never been to the River's Edge Brewing Company before? All right. Well, great to see so many new faces here. Rick Pluta, you have been to an Issues in Ale before.
He's working the crowd.
All right, we are going to get started here. I want to make a couple quick announcements before we get underway here. First off, I do want to thank Ryan and Carl and all the great folks here at River's Edge Brewing Company for providing us with this great venue for tonight's event. Let's have a big round of applause. A special shout-out to Kim Schneider, who's the head brewer here. Kim helped create a lot of these great beers that you're sampling tonight. We encourage you to drink responsibly, but try as many of them as you can, because there are some really good beers all up here. As I said, this is our final Issues in Ale event of 2014. We will be back in 2015 with lots more. If you want to keep up to date on what's happening with our Issues in Ale events, I would encourage you, if you're not already on our e-newsletter list, sign up for that. We're going to be passing around a little sign-up sheet. All you have to do is put down your name and email address, and we don't spam you. We don't give your email address to anybody else, but that way you'll be on our events list, and we'll keep you informed of our future events. You can also follow us on Twitter. We are at @issues_ale. So that's another way to keep up to date on our events coming up. Speaking of that, Kimberly Springer is here. Kimberly is our social media director. And Kimberly is going to be tweeting during our event tonight. So if you're on Twitter, you can follow there and feel free to post your comments there as well.
Retweet.
I can't even say that now. I only had a beer. We are also recording tonight's event, and we'll have that audio up on our website, and we'll have it available as a podcast. So when we get to the Q&A portion, please raise your hand. We'll come over to you with a wireless mic because we want to make sure, first off, that everybody here in the room can hear your questions and also so that we get it on the recording. So rather than shouting it out, raise your hand. I know it's a full house, so try to be persistent. We'll try to get to you and get to as many questions as we can throughout the evening. And the last announcement I have, I don't know if you noticed when you came in the lobby area there to your right, there was an entry drum, and we're giving away tonight a pair of tickets to see Paula Poundstone live. Paula is going to be at the Royal Oak Music Theater this Saturday night. So if you love her as a regular panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, it's your chance to see her live doing her stand-up routine. And we're going to do a drawing for a pair of tickets to see Paula Poundstone tonight. So if you didn't already enter, on your way out, make sure you stop by and fill out an entry form, and one of you will win a pair of tickets to see that show. So without further ado, let me introduce you to our host tonight. Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's senior political analyst. You can hear his... Absolutely. You can hear his commentary and opinions on Michigan Radio every weekday afternoon during Here and Now, and also Wednesday mornings during Morning Edition, and weekends during Weekend Edition. In addition to his duties at Michigan Radio, Jack is also a columnist for the Metro Times and the Toledo Blade, and a professor of journalism at Wayne State University. And without further ado, Jack Lessenberry.
That's right. I would like everybody to undress and line up alphabetically by height.
No, he's totally serious. You guys, I don't know why you're laughing.
No, the truth, I'm as like all political analysts, I never say anything that's not true. And the answer is a full disclosure. Zoe writes everything that I say, and these other folks make it sound good. But enough about me. I've always wanted to say, this fulfills my life. Tonight, introducing our guest on my far left, Matt Marsden, who is chief of staff for Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville. Is that the correct title?
I was chief of staff.
Former chief of staff for Congressman Joe Schwartz. And, you know, much like
I'm the chief cleaner of things.
So he can give us some legislative insight.
He finishes all pints, too. If you can't finish yours, just bring
exactly,
them up.
Exactly.
Bring them on up.
It's going to be a little icky at the end of the evening.
On my immediate right is Rick Puda, Michigan Public Radio's man in Lansing. And on his...
By the way, I want to say an alumnus of the Oakland Press.
Alumnus of the Oakland Press. Most of us have a past. on my far right is Zoe Clark, executive producer or extraordinaire. She's the person behind The Voice on Stateside and one of the people I most admire. So what I want to do is all of us, as you probably know, are quite capable of talking for 3.5 hours nonstop about subject about which we know nothing. But I'm going to start. I just want to ask a couple brief things, and I'm more interested, I think we all are, in knowing what's on your minds. So after we do a little preliminary, I'll recognize you if you have a question. We'll come over with our wireless mic. I'd like you to state your name, and I'm going to be ruthless about this. Ask anything you want, but ask a question. Don't make a speech, or I'll cut you off. But I want to most of you, we do have a little late-breaking news, is that there is finally what looks like some serious action on the roads, and I'd like Rick to tell us about what happened today.
This is actually a big deal. If you were wondering whether or not road funding was going to get done in lame duck, that it looks like a road funding bill is going to a House and Senate conference committee. And this is a big deal because you know that the Senate has passed a version and the House has passed a version. And what this means is now that the two chambers are going to get together and they are going to negotiate something that has to be voted up or down. No amendments, no negotiating once it gets to the floor. And I would say, and Matt could tell you, I think this means that they're serious about trying to make this happen.
Well, I think it was the smartest thing that they could have done because you went into this process with the Senate passing something that took care of all the funding, right? $1.8 billion of funding to fix the roads. The House countered by sending something that partially fixed it and were able to say to the Senate.
We should say the Senate version is to make it very sure, is a gas tax increase, and the House version is a tax shift.
Listen, let's be honest here. You're not going to fix these roads without everybody in this room feeling it. Okay, whether it's a fee increase, a tax increase, whatever way you want to call it, it's revenue out of your pocket to fix the roads. So the back and forth politically about, it's a tax increase, it's not a tax increase. The fact of the matter is, if you want the roads fixed, it's going to cost you more money.
Well, yes and no, because you are now paying a non-fixing road tax in terms of busted axles and tires.
Well, fair enough, but you're also paying a tax at the pump to pay for education.
Well, true, but I don't know that the things are mutually exclusive here, but most people say, especially in the Detroit metropolitan area, that however, whatever they sock you for fixing the roads is going to be less than the average amount that's added to people's bills because of the condition of the roads. But I want Matt to, and Rick and maybe Zoe to comment on one other thing. Is this MDOT? MDOT says it would cost $2.2 billion a year.
Well, that's a critical point there because I don't believe you're going to sell road funding to anybody in this room in terms of a tax increase or fee increase or new revenue unless you are able to say that there's more accountability at MDOT's level and that there's more accountability and responsibility by the road builders who are not fixing I-69 summer again and summer again and summer again, the same stretch of road. So I think that what's going to be critical for the legislature is to sell these folks in this room and the public in general that there's a greater level of accountability at MDOT's level and by the road builders. Then I think they'll be okay with it.
And some of this just goes to the timing, right? That there was a huge push in March and April thinking that this would actually be done, probably not in lame duck. I think a lot of us thought that maybe even in April or May before they...
Political suicide.
Went on summer recess. Said. A lot of folks thinking maybe, and then what Matt and Rick are saying is it would have been politically suicidal for some of these lawmakers to take a vote to raise your taxes before Election Day, which came. We are now in lame duck, which I think why probably a lot of us are thinking now that this conference committee could actually be the thing where we see some kind of road funding deal between both chambers and then for the governor to sign.
Let me ask you to comment. Say whatever you want to say, but first of all, address Matt's point about a accountability. Now, the way that Governor Snyder suggested fixing the roads was by a combination of registration fees and gas tax.
So birthday tax?
So let me finish. It was very simple to see how much it would cost. The Senate formula is incredibly complex, is it not? So are we?
I don't know. I haven't looked at it. It's too complex.
But right. So are we getting more accountability?
It's just politics, not it's just policy.
One point of clarification is that I think
please
that
remember
the
who you're talking to.
Took care of the whole $1.8 billion, which is what the road funders wanted. They wanted $1.8 billion to fix the roads. The Senate version increased the cost to get the $1.8 billion. The House took a different version to say, well, we're not going to do all the $1.8 billion that we've suggested is needed, but we'll be able to sell it. It's not a tax increase.
But, Matt, let's remember, too, there are some Republicans, conservative Republicans, who say that there isn't additional funding. Again, I would say crazy, but who say that through waste, fraud, abuse, some of the favorite terms that you hear lawmakers say that somehow, magically, because we haven't already found $1.2, $1.3 billion
in
the
budget. And don't forget economic growth.
Oh, economic growth, waste, fraud, and abuse. Suddenly, you can pile all this money
and
together.
And in fairness, Mark Schauer said much the same thing.
Mark Schauer actually told Rick Pluta to my left here that exact same thing, that we would be able to fix the state's budget, be able to do that, stop the pension tax on senior citizens. Are there children in the audience? So, again, this is what's really easy for lawmakers to say. There are some code words you hear, and when you hear things like, well, waste, fraud, and abuse, you can instantly know that is just not going to fix things, or economic growth, as Rick just said.
I think there are two things that are worth noting about this. One of them is this is a template campaign that we saw in the mid-1990s. Matt's nodding his head.
Explain what that means, Rick.
John Engler had to convince the Michigan public that it was time to raise the gas taxes. And remember, this is Governor Tax Cut. This was, and that's what he called himself. And it was time. And so one of the things that
talk
they
about
had,
the nickel.
Well, the nickel was the property tax.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
But he was still, but he called himself Governor Tax Cut. But he was advocating for a gas tax increase. And the first thing that they had to do, and they spent a solid year and a half. More than that, maybe, Matt. Am I wrong?
For sure.
Creating a campaign that basically vilified MDOT and said that we are squeezing every red cent out of this department that we can before we came to you for a gas tax hike. And I think that we're seeing something of the same thing.
But how indicative
going on
of
right
that
now.
Is then of the governor not being able to sell this plan? I mean, since he got in office,
well, Rick
in
Snyder is not John Engler.
And this is what I'm saying, that through the Medicaid expansion, which finally got through, roads, though, that we have seen time and time again that this governor has not been able to figure out how to get his fellow Republicans to play nicely with what he wants.
Well, that's accurate. And I mean, if you guys remember back to when they were talking about the bridge, they want to build a new bridge, and that fight happened. One of the things that they tasked me with at that time was to go out and try and figure out a way to say, if we build a new bridge, okay, we can fix X amount of smaller bridges inside each of your municipalities. And we went out on a road tour, and we tried to convince folks that one bridge across the river in Detroit will allow MDOT to get the federal matching funds to fix 4 or 6 or 7 dilapidated bridges in your local communities. And it went nowhere. It did, and to me, that's the public safety issue. The bridges and the infrastructure that we drive across there are a little bit more concerning than it is the potholes that you blow your tires on.
Well, maybe, and maybe that brings us to sort of the second part of what I wanted to mention, which is the Bolger proposal, which is the tax shift, that you don't have to actually raise
new
net
revenue
taxes.
Mm-hmm.
To, it's going to cost to revenue more, to fix the roads.
Right. That you shift the sales tax to transportation, and you count on economic growth to do the rest.
In the words of Pink Floyd, we don't need no education.
and that's it. But that's exactly it. And then your superintendents and your PTAs are there pounding at the door. And this is just a classic tactical move saying, fine, you can do it this way. It does move the institution, the legislature, closer to having a vote on transportation funding. They have to vote now on transportation funding, but now you have to make a choice between these two available options.
Well, and the conference committee puts the adults in the room.
Right. And the conference committee, yeah.
As you can see, we can talk forever, but I want to just end this right now, but I want real briefly everybody to give me their assessment. What are the odds that this is going to get through, starting with Matt? What are the odds in something actually happening major?
I think now that it's in a conference committee, something will be done.
Well, give me an odds. 80%, 90%?
Oh. Want me to put some odds on it, huh?
Yeah.
50-50.
Well, that's not much of a... no wonder
he's
in politics.
I spent 9 years there, man. Right.
Mr. Pluta.
I think the fact that it's in conference puts it at 60% or better.
Oh, I'm going to go a little higher. I'm going to go 75% just because I think there are enough term-limited lawmakers who are willing to take a couple tough votes before they are gone, and this will be one of them.
It's also the personalities in the room. Who's named to the conference committee?
And that's,
how well do they get along?
Absolutely.
And how grown up do they want to be about
it? And what else is on the table?
Yes.
What else is on the table? Well, I want to end by just invoking the mantra that his boss, Randy Richardville, started and Governor Snyder has now picked up, just fix the damn roads. Okay, who has a question? Where's our man with the microphone? There he is. That hand went up very fast. Sir, say who you are and what your question is and who it's for.
Fred Pearl, my question is for the panel, but I have read in transport magazines that compared to our neighboring states, every motorist in Michigan pays about $200 less annually for registration fees than Ohio, Indiana, Pennsylvania, all down the line.
First of all, if you read transport magazines, you know more than we do.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We just look at the pictures.
The train on page 4
and by
was
the
amazing.
Way, oh, man.
That centerfold of the F-150 truck.
I've got pictures on my phone.
I'll answer that question for you.
Are there children in the audience?
I think my wife's registration is 174 for a GMC Acadia. Mine's 166 or something for a GMC Terrain. That would have doubled under what has been coined the birthday tax. Every year, when my wife's birthday comes along, and I'm not paying 164, I'm paying essentially 264, 266, and then it was in
plus the cost of a birthday present, I hope.
Exactly. And then in the small print was, how many people out here have snowmobiles? How many people out here have boats? How many people out here have trailers? How many people here have motorcycles? Each one of those would have been impacted by what some called the birthday tax, okay? That was, it's a lot. That's a lot. And then you add, oh, you want to get into a state park? Take 176 or 166 to 176 to get into a park. Okay? Another $10. So the registration fee seemed burdensome.
Well, you know, I had my own birthday tax last year on my wife's birthday. Driving on Woodward Avenue going 30 miles an hour, I lost a $250 tire on my station wagon. And
it's
because
a fancy
of the
car.
Condition of the roads. Well, I just stolen it. And it
I want to ride with you, man.
But it was a brand new tire.
Driving dirty.
Going 30, hitting a pot roll. Isn't that right? So it's true. She's confirming I'm telling the truth for once. So that's another kind of tax.
Right, and this is the issue, again, that we're going to, this idea about taxes, that we can all sit down and complain about the roads, that folks will say, I'm willing to put a little bit more money into it, but lawmakers, they don't necessarily believe that if they vote that way, you are going to vote them back into office.
You know, we have a cottage up north, and we've got a stretch of road leading up to it that it actually improves in the winter.
Michigan Public Radio is paying all right if you got a place up north.
Not well enough yet, but...
Well, next year he's going to get a roof on it. Somebody else. Next question.
Yeah, come on. We have more hands out there. Steve,
Hi, my name's John Rolfe. Michigan has by far the highest utility electric rates in the Midwest. So what legislation do you see coming down the line that will help solve that problem?
Rip?
That might actually get passed.
Dear God, you sound like a press conference. actually, there are a few things going on right now in terms of
I think the biggest issue right now that folks are looking at, though, is this idea of renewable energy, that the EPA has decided that we can only, as all states, and this is federally mandated, that we have to meet a certain regulation per year, EPA standards. And one of the things that's happening in Michigan, particularly that we've done a lot of reporting on, in fact, is in the UP. That right now there are 16 coal power plants that are most likely going to close because of these new EPA regulations. 16 by 2016. It is actually going to be enough energy that gives enough energy to a million people that is going to be shut down by 2016. So that is something that lawmakers...
That is one of the big practical political questions that we have in the legislature about is whether we require what are called baseline power plants, which are basically coal plants, whether they're clean coal
or do you want nuclear?
Yeah, or do you want nuclear, but something that can produce big stuff? One of the big controversies in the lame duck session is, and this is actually, this doesn't specifically answer your question, and I apologize for that, and now I will move on, is whether or not burning rubber tires is a legitimate form of renewable
fuel. Energy.
Yeah. What?
Yes.
Burning tires?
Wait, are you kidding? Really? You haven't heard about this?
No. I mean, good Lord. I thought that was a protest play. I didn't know people were burning rubber tires.
No, so the House just passed.
That is a real bill.
Oh, the House.
Rick did not get the League of Conservation Voters Award this year. But,
no. Although Governor Snyder was the first Republican in Michigan's history to get their endorsement in 2010.
They notably unendorsed him.
Lisa Wozniak, the president, was like, nuh-uh, not anymore. We're going to see. I mean, so if there's 16 coal power plants close right now in the UP, right. We're already seeing folks.
Which, by the way, they won't.
Okay.
16 coal power plants will not close.
Okay.
I guess the bottom line, sir, is that I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for a tax cut for utilities.
And this goes.
I bought a wood-burning stove.
Mm. And this goes back to this trend that we're talking about, right? Which is that there are a lot of problems that the state is facing, whether it's the roads, whether it's environmental issues, things that money could probably fix. And what you will hear a lot of progressives, a lot of liberals, some moderates even say, is that we have seen so much cutting in the past decade. During the Great Recession, everything was cut. And is that going, you know, is that trend going to continue in Michigan? Or now, as we're starting to see some economic growth, do we start seeing some money put back into roads, some money put back into maybe some renewable energy? Or do we continue this trend of cutting? Or do we try to stay with inflation? And these are some really big issues right now that the state legislature, that the governor are trying to deal with. How much money do we put back into government after years of cuts?
Okay, next question. There's a gentleman right here. Sir, you want to ask a question? I'll repeat it.
Yeah.
Well, there we go.
Yeah, I'm Terry Gannon, a retired educator.
Hi, Terry.
And hi, all. And I certainly don't want to leave the road tax issue behind. What are chances coming out of conference that they will have to increase class size?
Increase class size because of the road?
Because of
a shift
in the tax.
Okay.
That, honestly, it's an imponderable. The state does not get to determine class sizes unless it does that. It's all about the foundation grant and all of that. And the House road plan relies on a projection of economic growth, and if it doesn't, then it reverts back to the old plan, you know, then to what we are right now. And the problem with that is that if we revert back to what we have right now, is then we don't have more money for roads. That's why I think that the House plan is actually kind of a red herring.
I think so much of this goes to what lawmakers end up hearing from parents, though. Right? I mean, if parents start
actually,
complaining
I don't think
enough,
I've been hearing it from parents as much as from superintendents and
but that's
school
what I'm
lobbies.
Saying, that when
then
parents...
then it comes down to parents.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That when you start actually seeing protests, right, when you actually see that, I mean, right now, you can call your lawmaker, you know, they'll listen to you, right? Or a staff member will listen to you. But it's not going to be until enough folks actually put their votes together, put their protests together, call enough to really try to change some minds. And obviously, we're not at that breaking point yet.
How many folks out here know that what part of what you pay at the pump in the gas tax actually goes to educating kids. That's a
everyone.
That's
not everybody.
60-70%
The problem that they had in the original design of trying to fix this situation was it's very difficult to explain to the public from a communication standpoint and a messaging standpoint that when you go to the pump and you pay, you're part of it's going to the roads and another part of it's going to public education. Okay, so to try and first off, educate everybody out there that that's what the current gas tax goes to, and then try and educate them as to how that shift will happen is a complicated thing to do. Now, it's beholden on us to do that.
Yeah.
But
and this goes back
I think it's two separate tracks.
No, but
is that
just
one
a second, Rick. This goes back to the idea of the eight-second soundbite, that is how lawmakers talk right now. And what's way easier for many people to say is waste, fraud, and abuse. That right now, lawmakers can't be trusted with your money. There is money right now to be found, and that is how we will spend
it. But that's exactly my point. It's two distinct tracks.
Exactly.
You know, one of them is that people get really annoyed when they find out that the money that they're paying that they're paying at the pump is not entirely that they expect it to be a user fee, and it's not.
Right.
But
they're not going to say
also
don't give
expect,
it to education.
But they also expect that the sales tax
right.
is being used for education.
Yeah.
And when they find out that there's a
right.
where those come together, that it's difficult to reconcile.
But as a political guy at the pump, every time I sit there and I fill up my car and I watch that thing tick, 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 and I'm going, geez, I'm paying more in taxes. So if they were going to strike while the iron's hot, what are gas prices now?
Low.
A little bit down. You might have a little bit more public.
Oh, this would be the optimal time
to
vote
That's my
on
point.
A big gas tax increase.
Yeah. Okay, are there any other issues? Does
so
anyone want to ask
that? Question? Moving on.
Sure. Next question, there's a lady here.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Kim Root, and I work for Huron Valley Schools, so I'm going to stick with education.
Do I know you?
You do know me. Hi. So is there any appetite in the legislature for fixing what is truly an inequitable education funding system? And I'll just give you the example of Huron Valley Schools. We receive about $7,000 per kid, and our neighbors receive about $11,000 per kid. So why is a kid in Huron Valley worth less than a kid in
Why don't we
West
start
Virginia?
With the man from the legislature?
Are you going to throw that to me, huh?
Well, it seems logical to me.
There's not an easy answer to that question, because I think a lot of it depends on it's constitutional. There's a ton of things that go into your question. I think that the easy answer to what you're saying is, did the legislature over the course of the last 4 years kick the out of public educators and make it their cause to try and reform public education? Yeah, they did. You know, they really did. And you can kick a cow too many times. And I think that they realized at the beginning of this year, as their kids were going back to school and they were seeing a different classroom, they were seeing different supplies, the Republicans in control of the state government kind of started to grasp that, you know, you can push it too far. You can take it too far, and you might have to dial it back and figure out how to fix it. So my point is that public education was a target early on in 2010 when this legislature took over. And from about 2010 to 2011, maybe a little bit later, they felt with charter schools and home schools and cyber schools and all these different things that they were going to do, that they were going to try and reform education. And I think that a lot of people whose kids, mine included, go to public education, even as a Republican, although some Republicans wouldn't like to put me in their category, but went, you know what, enough's enough. And I think we need to try and figure out how to fix that. And I think that's an important thing that Republicans now in total control of the legislature need to focus on.
Rick, you actually talked to Democrats, too. What do you think?
I'm expected to talk to Democrats?
Well, there's two or three still in the legislature.
I was going to say, he can find one or two milling about.
The appetite right now for... I think what you're talking about, Kim, is... sort of exploding the current system and, you know, trying to do what Proposal A was partially supposed to do is not there. I mean, it's just not there right now.
Let me ask you, ask everybody briefly. In March, it'll be 21 years since we passed Proposal A. Is it time to redo it? Zoe? Yeah.
Well, I wasn't born yet. So yeah, look, oh, I'm totally joking. I wish. I was carded this evening, though. Thank you. No, I mean, yeah, and that's what some lawmakers are going to absolutely say. Again, it's what Rick is saying, though, is this year, last session, we had Republicans in charge. The upcoming session, we are going to even see more conservative Republicans in charge. We saw Mark Schauer try to make education funding his number one issue, along with the pension tax, and we saw that turned out for him. I mean, the governor absolutely went defensive on it. It was probably the angriest we've seen the governor in the past 4 years defending whether or not there was $1 billion cut
to education.
He was
told to get angry.
I'm so angry right now. That's my bad, bad Governor Snyder impersonation. But no, I mean, and this goes back again to what Terry is saying, that, you know, there is a lot of anger about education in the state right now. I think lawmakers realize that. But they have not been persuaded by that anger enough to do anything about it. And they are not going to make tough, hard political decisions that could endanger their future until their feet are to the fire, and their feet are not to the fire.
I'm not sure you can do a Proposal A redo like happened during the time frame we're talking about in a term-limited legislature.
But if you remember, Matt, the legislature really didn't do that. They put it on the ballot. They gave people two options, Proposal A. There was another option that wanted to do it, raise the income tax to...
It was the income tax, and there was actually, it was a campaign that was run against tobacco taxes.
Right.
That Joe Camel was the big villain.
And that took a lot of guys and ladies who had been together for a lot of time working as elected officials to hatch that sort of a thing. And I'm not sure in a term-limited...
That there would be
environment that you're going to find those relationships.
Proposal A is largely regarded as sort of sacred even still, but I don't know. The fact that Proposal A happened was as much happenstance as much as anything else. It was not like a lot of things that happen in politics, very, very, very much planned. It was an opportunity, and then a bunch of dominoes started to fall.
Jack, why don't you quickly explain Prop A for folks who might not completely understand or maybe just move to the state?
I was afraid you'd ask me that. Well, this isn't in March. There was
I was there. Please explain it to me.
Well,
I hear you there.
They ended up sort of there was a political ploy which. Sort of mushroomed, and they ended up pulling the plug on the conventional way of funding education. They put this on the ballot, these two proposals, and Proposal A, of course, set a minimum foundation grant, severely limited the amount of money communities could raise via millages to fund their schools, and the idea was that it would save districts like Kalkaska. In the old days, Kalkaska was always the poster child for school districts that ran out of money. And when it was passed, I was doing a bunch of Michigan stuff with the New York Times, and I went to see a principal in Bloomfield Hills. And I said, what do you think of this? He said, I'm resigning tomorrow. He said, at the end of the year, rather. He said, because I now will not be able to keep this school up to compete with private schools. He said, this is going to be very good for the Kalkaskas of this world for 10 to 15 years, and then everybody's going to be ruined by it. So...
And a woman by the name that you might have heard of, Debbie Stabenow, had...
Ended up becoming sort of a political casualty of this.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Things have turned out well.
Do we really want to tell that story?
No. It's too long. It's too long ago. It's too long ago. But so nobody... Again, nobody thinks there's going to be an opportunity to redo Proposal A, and we're stuck with it for the foreseeable future. I want to ask the panel to comment on something that's been in the back of my mind. We've all been talking... And everybody, all the media in Michigan has been talking as if on, they better get stuff done now because this is the last year of the Roman Empire. And on January 1st, the Visigoths are coming in to take control of the legislature, and they're going to repeal plumbing. And they're certainly not going to be in favor of anything good or any tax increase ever at all. And I'm wondering, and there's sort of, I'm exaggerating, but not a lot. I'm wondering, Rick, do you think we're going to have a total impasse when the new, more conservative, more Tea Party-centric legislature comes in?
I'm for plumbing. Just to put, let's get that on the record.
When it's cold, anyway.
Yeah. God, I want to give you a pithy answer, and I don't know. That governors are supposed to do stuff, and we may be moving into a legislature that doesn't want to do stuff. And my experience is that's not the way it works.
It goes back, I think, a lot to this idea of how, and Matt, you brought it up earlier, how far can voters get pushed? And we see this on a national level, too. This is why we see wave elections like we did in 2006.
But I don't think we just saw a wave election.
I don't either. But this is what I'm saying. No, it was not.
It was a 3.1 million turnout, okay? That was almost less than 2010, which was the last.
It was less than.
Wave election. I'm being generous since the Secretary of State hasn't quite. Right. We don't have all the numbers yet. But the reality of the matter is that this was not a wave election. This was the fact that Lon Johnson had a plan. Right. Lon Johnson's plan was to try and drive up absentee voters. Did he do that? Yes, he did. He drove it up by 100,000.
Not just absentee voters, but it was clearly a big part of it.
But in speaking in terms of what his stated goal was, the Democratic Party chairman's goal was to use the Obama list.
Actually, he did drive up absentee voters.
100,000 applications.
But it was on trend.
Applications. Okay. What happened is they failed to deliver them in Wayne County in the city of Detroit. Okay. Now, he succeeded in the fact that he got over 100,000 new people who do not traditionally vote in non-presidential years to ask for an absentee ballot. The problem was that he just didn't quite get them across the finish line. He left about 76.7% of those absentee applications that were filed on the counter. That means that he got people to ask for them, fill it out, get the ballot, and then they left it on the counter, which to me is baffling because he went all the way almost there, but they couldn't quite get it across. And, you know, Planned Parenthood, League of Conservation Voters, Sierra Club, all groups that are very effective in how they operate, were able to go out and find these people using the Obama lists and deliver an application.
And this actually, I was having a really interesting conversation with Mark Brewer, who Lon Johnson got kicked out of the chairmanship. And Mark Brewer was saying exactly that yes, they got the absentee votes out there, and it looked if people had filled them out. Mark Brewer said, in fact, what he thought was interesting is he didn't get one phone call. Now, given maybe you look on that list and you see Mark Brewer, you know, chair of the former Michigan Democratic Party, 100% votes for Democrats, doesn't think he needs a phone call. But if someone like that, they're seeing that he got it 5 weeks before, you know, Election Day, and he has not turned it in yet, the fact that someone is not giving him a ring to say, hey, what's going on here is pretty indicative of follow through. But I think it, Jack, to go back to your question about the idea that is, you know, all gloom and doom come January 1st when the new session of the legislature, and is that unfair to say? I don't think it is. We are seeing
conservative. You've been talking about the governor's race, though, but the legislature is slightly more Republican. But some of the people who've been, that Randy Richardville is gone. He's being replaced by a man who's much more far right.
Yeah.
We've got Todd Corser and his mini-me, Cindy Gamrat, two of the most radical Tea Party people. We've got
Gary Glenn
who thinks the rhythm method is against God. And so,
Jeff, just stand up. I'm like, just let's.
So seriously, that's what I meant. Not that there's going to be so many more.
Right.
I mean, the Democratic caucus, I saw them out there. They were in an Acura. And,
all together.
That's right.
They had to find someone to drive them.
Well, while they're all breaking their arms, slapping themselves on the back, thinking that they won some wave, the reality of the matter is 2016 is the presidential year.
Right.
If we see a female at the top of the ticket in 2016, I can guarantee you right here and now that the House will flip. Okay. The Senate, what happened in the Senate with 27 seats being won, will definitely impact for years the course of the Michigan Senate. That will not change. That is a difficult hurdle to climb. The House will flip in 16 because of the people you just named.
Right. So you think there could be a 9-seat flip?
The State House?
State House.
You think it'll flip?
In 16? With a woman at the top of the ticket, Hillary, in a democratically leaning state in presidential election years, I'd wager you $100 right now, Will.
Well, it didn't flip. It didn't flip 2 years ago.
I work for public radio. I don't have $100.
Hey, you've
but
got
that was
a cottage,
Obama's second
mister.
Term.
But he won by 500,000 votes still. Well,
he's not a woman.
Well, fine. Well, but in the meantime, the next Matt.
Everything lines with female voters.
Well, that's true. But the next two
I'll
years,
take that.
Is this legislature going to do anything?
I'm sure they're going to do a lot of things, whether or not
I mean,
they're smart politically.
I mean, they'll proclaim Flag Day and things like that, but whether, you know.
But this goes back to the question of this idea that can you go too far and suddenly.
I'm not sure how many more things you can do on social issues. I'm not sure how many more things you can do on issues that divide the female voter,
although
minority
the interesting
population
thing that we're seeing
voters,
in this lame duck session is that these things are
continuing.
Being put on the table. I don't know.
Of course they are because
I don't know if the votes are there, but they're being put there for a reason.
And that's what I'm trying to figure out here right now is when is for these folks and I'm not trying to put any other analysis than just when is enough in terms of moderate voters and Democrats who are, you know, are more in population in the state of Michigan.
Enough will be enough when people decide to come out and vote in off presidential years.
Bingo. Bingo. But that didn't happen in 2014. That didn't happen a month ago when we heard so
right.
much about the
no,
fact
and it's
that
frustrating.
It was going to. Yeah.
Yeah. That turnout model is absolutely disgusting to me.
It was really sad.
I mean, it defied even Rev6 Data, which is a company that we run that focuses on lists and micro-targeting people. We took the lowest possible model that we could, and it was about just under 3.2. And we were cynical in our approach.
Got under
and
it.
It went under even what our model had. So in terms of participation, it's up to the people that are in this room and out there on the street to remember. It's not just presidential years. It's these gubernatorial
years. Matt,
I guess there are two things. One of them is that I suspect it's not the people in this room.
I was just going to say I think it's the exact opposite.
And then people that are here that care
here.
Go out, you know.
But, that little girl over there didn't vote. The one that's about 8 years old. She did not vote.
Hey, well, you know what? The Secretary of Senate has sent some absentee ballots to 13-year-olds.
What I hear all the time is... you know, in election cycle, off-year election cycle, not presidential right. Election cycles, is all you have to do is change the turnout model.
And I think
all
that's what Lon Johnson was trying to do.
Right.
Oh, he was. I mean, clearly he was. And a lot of people bought that it was possible because, you know what? It seems possible.
Well, up until the election day, we get absentee ballot reports back every day from the Secretary of Senate. We're able
we
to
be,
tell...
Well, before us nerds, totally, we love this stuff, but we don't have any friends. Before we bore everybody to death...
Who wants to play Dungeons & Dragons?
Good job, Jack. Let's ask a question. This gentleman in the red coat.
Good evening. Name is Bill Antrim. I've got two kids, 11 and 13, and I'm concerned about the cost of higher education. It's really, really, really going up.
You've got two kids and you're at the bar with a drink in your hand.
My kind of guy.
But you're concerned.
Now you know what it's like to hang out with Jack Lessenberry.
Exactly.
Actually, this gentleman, let me defend this gentleman now that I've attacked him. I am a social parasite. I'm a professor. I'm the head of journalism at Wayne State, and I'm depending on your kids being able to afford an education, right?
Yeah, it's going up double digits per year. When do you see that, you know, what is causing that, and when do you see, is it going to level off, is it going to collapse, or, you know, what's happening there?
Mr. Pluta?
You're the professor.
You've got two kids.
Yeah.
You've got little kids.
Yeah, how screwed are you?
I'm the professor.
Well, do I see it level, what do you say, what do you think, Zoe?
I just was reading a report by Brookings that says there's nothing in the near future that is going to do anything to stop that and anything to level it out. And when you talk to administrators, right. I live in Ann Arbor, where there is one of my interns was just telling me her dorm freshman year, she had a sushi bar. There was her organic peanut butter frozen yogurt bar. And, I mean, you know, a climbing wall and her friend who had the apartment with her girlfriend who had the hot tub access. So, you know, what administrators are saying is, this is what parents want, that we need to be able to get students to come to our schools. I think what we're going to need is some school to say, you know what, we're the affordable choice.
And you know what?
And here's what we don't have.
Your kids need to join the Army. And well, I'll tell you how to fix it. I know how to fix it. What we need, ladies and gentlemen, is the Soviet Union back. When I was 5 years old, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, and they freaked out. And the government made vast amounts of money available so that even social parasites like the four of us up here, who probably couldn't do long division without taking our socks off,
I take back
get
what I said.
Money
what Jack
to go
said.
To yeah. school yeah. because we made it a priority. And now we don't. I don't know why. It's more important now than ever.
Yeah.
Your kids cannot get jobs in the line at Oldsmobile like my generation could. And it is very baffling to me, and is a thing that scares the hell out of me, frankly. It's a very good question. Matt, why aren't your guys fixing it?
Well, I think my guys, but I think that there's been an interesting trend under the new governor to try and take community colleges and public universities and combine the funding streams. I think that one thing that people fail to understand is that public universities are constitutionally autonomous. Okay, state constitution.
The state constitution says they're autonomous, and that is where the legislative process gets weird.
They've definitely tried to insert themselves a little further than normal in that process, but the fact of the matter is that when you start to combine community colleges with vocational schools with public universities, tie in public education from a K through 12 standpoint, you start to muddy the waters a lot, okay? And it becomes more difficult, and budget lines become smaller and smaller and smaller, and it's harder to tell where things are going, and the universities are saying, well, you're changing the pattern of how we've done things. Now, then we could enlarge this into a larger conversation. How much is college sports? I'm paying a ton of money for four-season tickets to Michigan State University football. How much of that is getting kicked back to track the cost of student tuition, all of those things. I mean, there are universities make a lot of money. University of Michigan could be a Harvard, if they will. They could sit alone. They don't need public education. Their endowment is what, one of the largest in the country?
More than 9 billion, yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, in part, it's up to the Board of Regents and the people that you elect to run your universities to make these decisions.
But this isn't just a Michigan issue, I think, is what I was trying to say, is this is an issue about what the national economy is doing, that it used to be, you know, the economy sort of looked like this, that there were, you know, some really high-end earners and some really low-end earners, and now it looks more like this, right, where there's a lot of low-end earners and high-end earners, and the middle class is getting shrunk, and it's only going to that's only going to continue if the
In fact, this gentleman is the middle class. That's why I invited him to here tonight. Mm-hmm. But if I can be serious for a minute, this issue outrages me more and worries me more than about anything else. Every generation prior to the present wanted their kids to have it better than they did. My parents felt that way. Their parents felt that way. It seems to me now we're saying, yeah, there's a bumper sticker that says, you know, screw my grandkids, I'm using their inheritance. And it makes me mad because I have a wonderful life, you know. I'm with the love of my life. I've got a nice house. I've got a case of peanut butter in the basement. I've had an opportunity to do these things. My students, that beautiful little redheaded girl over there, she's more important than I am. Your kids, it's important that they got the shot that I do, and I think it's unconscionable that our leaders in society don't feel that way and that we're not all yelling at them. We need all of us to be more concerned about our kids and less concerned about ourselves, and I'll get off my soapbox.
And I'll get on mine for 1 second and say that I think
so. Just shut up.
That it's important that the state of Michigan doesn't. What is important? What level does the community college have its role? And at what level does a vocational college have its role? And at what level does the university? All of them are important. But what I've seen over the course of the last 4 years is that there's a blending of it to say, oh, the university should be equal to the community college. The community college should be equal to the vocational school. The vocational, what is the priority? What is the standard? And I think that needs to be a part of the larger
context. Matt is absolutely, let me clarify something I said. I'm not saying that everybody needs a 4-year degree from a university. I mean, we need higher education. People that do vocation, they don't like that term. The best outfit in the state doing it is Macomb Community College. I mean, there is nothing shameful about being a plumber or a
tradesman.
Welder, a tradesman. But the point is, thank you, nothing. But But the point is, you cannot get out of high school without higher education of some kind and have a prayer of making it in today's economy, and that's what we need to address.
And one issue you are seeing in the legislature is the idea of adding some four-year degrees to some of the community colleges here in the state. And so
is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, that is a usually political
box of worms. Nursing.
There's somebody else. This gentleman back here. Yes, sir. You. We're getting Steve as exercise tonight.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Stop and ponder the fact that you know you deserve this question.
Yeah. Well, you deserve this question, and then I deserve the answer.
Well played, sir. Well played.
Well played. Buy this man a beer.
I'm Lou Tripp. I live here in Milford.
Hi, Lou.
And I'm a graduate of vocational auto. I went to community college, and I graduated from University of Michigan. So I went through all three steps, and then four steps was industry. So I don't care about that. What I want to ask about was the people of Michigan spoke twice in petitions to stop wolf hunting in Michigan. And then we spoke again in a vote to stop wolf hunting in Michigan. But the legislature again stands up for wolf hunting in Michigan.
Too damn bad, Lou.
And that's the way it stands
well,
right now.
Lawmakers were all like, we'll see, you know, you're not
but
voting.
But you were just talking about how, you know, people need to stand up for what they believe in and speak up for what they believe in. The legislature will listen. They're not listening. So I want to know what's going to happen about that issue, because that's what's important to me. So that's my soapbox. Thank you.
Hey, you want to say something, Matt?
That might have been those ballot shifts on wolves might have been the dumbest damn thing I've seen in my time in the legislature. To your point, sir, people said they didn't want it, and then you got two competing ones, and I can't even understand what it is when I'm reading it. All other, you want to shoot wolves for what? I'm not seeing a whole lot of them around here. But I mean, why don't you look at that? I mean, the thing about it is, if you want to look at it from a logical standpoint, first of all, it's a dumb issue, okay, in my opinion, and that's what I offer. But number two, if you look at the population centers, Oakland County, Macomb County, Wayne County, I don't think there's a whole lot of wolf problems. I'm not seeing a lot. And so I don't understand the logic of what they wanted to do, except for the fact that there were people, special interests, that were more than willing to fund these ballot initiatives and put them on the ballot and run them. And I don't know what the point of it was, but I agree with you.
The point of it was...
But under the federal...
But this was strictly for sport hunting. And I just totally disagree. I mean, if your cattle and your ranch is being impacted
by this... But you can
this,
do that. You can shoot them.
And that's always been the case. And people were compensated by any damage that the wolves had done. But this was purely just a stick in the eye to the environmental...
Let's let Rick Pluta weigh in on this. Rick?
This is because there is a particular state senator from the Upper Peninsula named Tom Casperson. Who was very effective, and he's done a lot of things for southeastern Michigan, and
especially in terms of transportation.
Yeah, and so he was able to. As a matter of fact,
roads don't look too good, so he hasn't done too good of a job.
Actually,
you got a rail line running on Woodward.
He may be the most effective legislator in the legislature.
Let me put this in somewhat more of a global context. Apart from the wolves themselves, does things like this, when people vote one way and they take it, the people's right away, does that foster more cynicism about government in Michigan?
Absolutely, and I think it's not just the wolf issue. I would say it's the idea of the emergency manager that voters, you know, voted against it. The legislature came back. They created another bill. They passed that bill. The biggest one this year, I think, probably was how many of you voted to increase the state's minimum wage? So there was a ballot petition to increase the state's...
None of you did.
So maybe we should just become a part-time legislature and do everything by ballot initiative.
Well, and look, that's a very fair question. I think what I was going to say, though, about the minimum wage ballot is that right there was a fundamental question.
But it also speaks to how big a state we are.
Sure, but that was a fundamental question that voters wanted to see, and it looked like a majority of the voters wanted to at least see it on the ballot. And some really smart lawyers and some lawmakers, I didn't say smart lawmakers, some really smart lawyers and some lawmakers figured out a really incredible way around it. And so what I think you're getting to is this idea that it seems like a lot of time lawmakers are spending more time figuring out how to go against the will of voters than it is to figure out some solutions.
What about personal property tax? The PPP
ballot issue. I think that's absolutely a fair comment to make.
Okay. By the way, I have a compromise proposal I'm trying to get someone to introduce on the wolf hunting, where wolf hunting would be legal, but you would have to do it naked while holding a steak knife.
I'm down with that, man.
And I'm in favor of that. Next, this lady right here, this lady in the brown.
Hold on. Okay.
Because she's just too charming.
Hi, Linda Blaine. I am wondering what the odds are that the electoral votes will be split in Michigan?
Zero.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. Okay.
Let me follow up on Linda. Might it happen next year, though, Rick?
Zero.
No. Zero? Okay. Well, that answers that. This gentleman...
Do you want to have a conversation about it? But no.
No. This gentleman here.
Yeah, my name is Peter Worthman.
Hi, Peter.
Hi. And what I want to know is what your assessment is of this very disconcerting House bill having to do with people and their sincerely held religious beliefs.
RFRA.
And their ability
RFRA.
To deny services to people who don't hold those same beliefs.
Well, it's not specifically to deny services to people who hold those beliefs. It is a it's a RIF, and I don't mean that as a pun.
Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Off of what the federal government did quite a few years ago, which is that the idea is that you will pass a law that the federal government can when they enact a policy that they have to do it in such a way that it has the least possible impact on how people might practice their religious
You're
beliefs.
Being so
it's the
nice
personification
and
of politically
so delicate
stupid
about
is
this.
It is.
And let's go like doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, and let's go back to
the idea of the Michigan RFRA was that it would move in tandem with an update of the Michigan Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act to include gay rights and transgender rights. And
I believe that John Engler introduced as a state representative a bill that would have amended Elliott Larson and allowed gays and transgender to be included in that particular bill.
And you would
bill.
Be wrong. The lawmaker that you're thinking of is Jim Dressel.
Yeah, who then got voted out.
John Engler actually introduced one that permitted prostitution, to legalize prostitution. So, where he was afraid.
I think right. The fundamentals...
But this is actually, in fact... a high-minded bill designed to allow you to discriminate against gay people.
Which is a Jace Bulger, don't mess with me, and watch what happens when you try to, you know, to try to do something
but,
that I don't want
let's
you
ask,
to do.
To make your question practical, let's ask Rick and Matt, what are the chances the Senate's going to pass this?
Almost none.
I think they've already done too much damage, and it's going to be a ballot proposal in 2016, and they'll spend X amount of dollars to make sure that... If they were smart, they would say, listen, it's an economic issue. If you want to bring people to Michigan and you want people to work in Michigan, then you don't discriminate against them whether or not they're gay, they're transgender, they're whatever. Discrimination is discrimination, and to me, for them to argue on this point is one of the dumbest things I've ever heard.
And I'm not sure...
And it will only be a ballot issue if...
For $2 million, I could pass a ballot initiative.
Remember what the man does.
Yeah. But also, it depends on what the Supreme Court does with gay marriage.
Well, if we look what the circuit court's done out of Ohio on this issue in many cases, yeah. I think that we're going to see a trend that's...
Well, but
you're
going
to support
not...
the right of any individual to be who they are, where they are, and not be discriminated in the workplace and in renting a house. Right. That's what this is about.
But I think it's conceivable, don't you, that even if the Supreme Court says same-sex marriage is... constitutional and constitutional everywhere, that they still might try to put this on the ballot.
I hope they do.
Absolutely.
Right. This gentleman in the hat back here has been asking.
Quickly, I just want to say one really quick thing, which is that there has been a lot of social media talk about RFRA and some bills. One of the biggest things that's going around on social media is the idea that an EMT wouldn't have to, take care of someone. They were called to a home. Let's say the person had a heart attack. Let's say that person, because of their religious beliefs, didn't want to take care of someone they believed was transgender. Something like that.
I couldn't go to the hospital to care for my partner if I was gay in Michigan now.
Let's be really careful because what we've seen with court cases in the past throughout other states that have had similar things, that what courts will balance is fundamentally which is more important, someone's life or someone being able to make sure that their religious beliefs aren't hurt. And what we've seen courts do is make sure that human life and things like that are protected. So although RFRA is a very intense bill and for some people seems really incredibly out there, which I think a lot of people agree it is, some of the fundamental things that some bloggers are saying could happen because of it are very, very extreme. And what we've seen in other states is that is not the possibility of something that
RFRA
could happen.
Is
so I just want to put that out there, that there's been some really overblown claims about what RFRA would do. There are some really terrible things that I think some people would say it could do. Not operating on someone. Things
it's not
like
something
that
should be done in lame duck. I can tell you that.
Yeah. And it's a negotiating point that will not be a law come 2015.
There's no reason for this.
Actually, I was very excited because I thought it was a bill to permit riffraff, which applies to me
sounds like
and most of my friends.
No, we joked about it.
I want to go to the gentleman in the hat here. This poor gentleman here has been trying to ask a question.
Did you have a question?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
We live in a representational democracy, but if we have gerrymandered districts, it ruins representational democracy. Is there any hope that we could ever have an independent agency and some kind of impartial agency that would step in and not allow for the gerrymandering of our representational districts?
Mr. Pluta?
Probably not, but... you know, people are actually starting to talk about it.
I will say this is a question that we get at every single Issues and Ale. Every single time we're here, it is, what is the problem with gerrymandering? What is the problem with redistricting? Someone will inevitably say, well, what about Ohio? Someone inevitably will say, well, people aren't very happy with what they're doing in Ohio. Look, something I think needs to be changed. One thing I will say is don't think for a second that if Democrats weren't able to draw the maps that they wouldn't do the exact same thing in favor of themselves. Oh, look, absolutely. You can't argue with the fact that right now there are more registered Democrats in the state of Michigan, and yet right now when you look at congressional districts...
But they don't get out and vote.
Yeah, they don't vote. That's
well, actually, they aren't registered. We don't have party registration. But, one thing that could happen, sir...
But I could ID you.
If the Democrats were to elect a governor in 2018, then at least they would control that branch of government when the next round of this happened. And so that at least there would be some compromise. But... we just have to, especially if they manage to also, if as Matt predicts, let's say Hillary Clinton were to be elected and Democrats were to hold on to the Michigan House of Representatives, then you would have to have some compromise, would we not?
You would have to, but again, then I'd turn back to the Senate with a 27-seat majority, and the redistricting model is probably screwed for 20 years.
Look, fundamentally, I mean, you're correct in what you're saying, which is that in congressional races, more Democrats voted, and yet more Republicans are being sent to D.C.
Same in the state house.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Of which some of those will probably lose in 16.
Right. The gentleman behind the gentleman who just spoke.
I'll give you a proviso. This is probably unanswerable. But given the Michigan...
We're ready to go.
Can we see some of those truck pictures in that magazine?
Given the Michigan system of grand juries, justice, district attorneys, et cetera, how likely do you expect we could have, if we had a similar situation to Eric Garner or Michael Brown in Michigan, how would that play out in terms of a grand jury situation here?
I'm going to put that question to Matt.
Okay. I mean, look,
I meant that was a really unfair question.
I'm going to take a stab at it to let Matt off the hook. I think a couple things. I think that because of our past, we're much more sensitive to that, and I think it's much less likely, you never know, that we'd have that kind of a situation in either place. If we did, I don't think we'd have a grand jury. The best sort of analogy to that was a 1992 Malice Green case in Detroit, where you had a black man, crack addict, beaten to death by two white policemen, and I don't think there's a grand jury. I think the prosecutor brought charges. Was there a grand jury? No, there wasn't. And the policemen went to trial, and they were convicted, and there was no threat of civil disturbance whatsoever. So God forbid we have that, but I think that's one area where Michigan sort of has had more experience of that kind of thing.
Grand jury system has been historically around for a long time, and it may have its faults, and it may have its problems. And to answer the question and not skirt it, the fact of the matter is when you're talking about changing the legal system, it's very different than changing things like gerrymandering or changing things like, you know, the voting and election laws. Right. I mean, we're talking about a system that has been in place for eons. And is it fair always? No, but it is the legal system under which all of us are going to be judged at some point if we do something wrong or right or whatever it is. So you have to. It's hard. That's a hard question to answer because that's not politics. That's the law.
And I'm going to add something that you might find odd coming from someone who is perceived basically as an old liberal. None of us were in those grand jury proceedings. None of us were there. I know what it looks like to all of us, and I have serious questions about what the police did in either case, but we weren't there. And I know enough about trials and courts and lawyers and judges to know that we have to at least open our minds to the fact that we don't have all the facts. How about that man back there, the tall fella?
I'm not sure if I was the right guy, but I'm elected, and Lou here started the environmental sort of theme. And I would like to add to that because today, this is a national scale, the House of Representatives passed the GLRI, which the House of Representatives is the most dyslexic. I mean, they passed an environmental funding law.
Are we talking about the national or the state?
The national, but this is the Great Lakes State.
Right.
Four out of five Great Lakes prefer Michigan, all that. You know, my question is, an environmental issue on a national scale, the Great Lakes got recognized. Why can't... I'm trying to formulate a question.
I see that.
But it's amazing to me that someone agreed that
I've worked with Jack. I feel your pain.
A group of people that can't get anything done actually got behind an environmental law that... is good.
Are you talking about the Great Lakes Compact, sir?
The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, right. The GLRI. Okay. It just went through the House today, sent back to the Senate. Why can't we solve any other issues when an environmental issue, which is something that we don't get a lot of support on?
But, well,
I mean, there seems to be some momentum there.
I agree with that. I'll turn this over to anyone else who wants to speak. But first of all, it hasn't been passed by both houses of Congress yet. But Matt, what do you think?
Well, I think one thing that all the states that are around the Great Lakes have done a good job of, despite their political differences, is to protect and do what they can for the Great Lakes. Regardless of a Republican or Democrat, I think that the one thing that they can all come together on, whether it's Levin or Stabenow or whoever it may be, is that these waterways are more than just places that we play. They're places that we move products, we move and ship things. It's important to us, the carp. We can go back to all of those things. I think that's one apolitical issue that the state of Michigan, Wisconsin, other bordering states all share unitedly on being passionate.
But in case there's any irrational burst of optimism here, we still don't seem to have solved the problem of the 100-pound big head carp that are going to kill us all.
But they haven't gotten into any of the Great Lakes yet.
As far as we know.
Well, no, but remain vigilant.
This is something something that I think you can look back on some Republicans and Democrats being able to compromise on. You look at Governor Milliken being, you know, a big advocate for the environment for Great Lakes. I remember, Jack, when I first started working with you, Patricia Burkholz and Rebecca Warren.
Right.
In the House and Senate working on the Great Lakes Water Compact, a Republican, a Democrat. It does seem to be every now and then that it's something that Republicans and Democrats can work together on. It would be nice if there were some other issues that we could see some of the same bipartisanship on, absolutely. It is nice to say, though, that at least we're seeing a little bit of it and that the environment is benefiting because
of it. Steve, there's a gentleman back tall. You got somebody here? Oh, okay, I can see.
Hi, my name is Audrey, and as an educator, I wanted to ask about teacher evaluations. There's been a lot of talk in the legislature about universal teacher evaluations.
Yes, there have.
Do you think we can reasonably expect to see something passed? And if yes, what can we reasonably expect to see?
I think that the it's become so controversial that it's just it's stalled.
Yeah, this is something that we'll keep an eye on. I'm not sure if it'll pass in lame duck.
This will carry over into the next year.
Yeah, and look, this is something that, again, goes to student test scores, which then somehow has managed to bring in Common Core and the Smarter Balanced. So what we're seeing is Lisa Lyons, who's the chair of the Education Committee in the House, kind of keeping an eye on all of these different bills that we're watching in education. I don't think it's going to be something that happens in lame duck. It'll be something that's pushed on to the next year.
And I think it's something they need to be very, very, very careful on, being married to a public educator and inserting my personal bias. Look, it's a slippery slope when you get into that, because if you look at Waterford, Michigan, you had a high school teacher, history teacher, that was driven out because he didn't meet the criteria under the new guidelines. Now, remember, I'm going to bring this back to politics. It's who you elect as your school board. It's who you elect as the people that help to set that stuff. You've got to be cognizant of that, because the teacher evaluation part was a very, very touchy issue early on in 2010 as we started to do these public education reforms.
Audrey, there's an online magazine called Bridge, which is published by the Center for Michigan, and in the issue that comes out later this week, Phil Power has a long column about that very issue. I edited this column, so it's about these bills and where they are in the legislature.
And
no,
Ron,
spelling errors, right?
No spelling errors.
And Ron French with Bridge 2, along with Phil, has been doing a really amazing job, and Chastity Pratt. And we have them on stateside a lot to talk about teacher evaluations and Common Core and all of those things.
Great. Steve, how about that man in the back with his hand way up there? He's been there for a long time.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the environment. My name is Jeff, by the way.
Hi, Jeff.
And what I want to know about is it's energy and also energy. What's your opinion on the explosive growth of wind energy in the Thumb, particularly Huron County? Because there's a problem there now with Geronimo Energy. They are going to be building the windmills closer than the 3-mile setback from Lake Huron, as they're supposed to do, and it's a major migration corridor for golden and bald eagles and swans and waterfowl, and there's already been thousands of eagles killed out west because of wind energy. I just want to know your thoughts on it.
Do you want a nuclear plant?
No.
I mean, I don't know specifically the region that, I mean, the Thumb, obviously. I don't know what this company is doing. It's an interesting story if they are fundamentally moving the goalposts, let's say, proverbially, closer than they're supposed to be. That's something we should be looking at and reporting on. Look, wind energy, you know, the state has decided that we have a renewable energy goal, wind, solar to get to, and wind energy is something that Michigan is into right now and probably will continue to be. I'd be interested in, you know, into talking to you later about what this company's name is again and checking in on it.
Let me make a little footnote to that. At the time of 3 Mile Island, remember 3 Mile Island and the almost nuclear meltdown? I was working for a newspaper that was owned by a scientist, and he said to me, what we need to do now is have a crash program of building nuclear plants. And I said, politely, because he was my boss, that's impossible. He said, yes, I know it. But if they built them now, they would be ultra safe. Eventually, they'll have a crash program to build them when we run out of energy because Americans won't tolerate being cold. And you may remember, some of you who are as old as I, that we once had a president named Jimmy Carter who said, put on a sweater and turn down the thermostat, and he lost 44 states.
And that went over so well.
That's right.
And he grew good peanuts.
Pardon?
He was a peanut farmer.
He was a peanut farmer, yes.
And had lust in his heart.
Of course, there are those who say that if we really want wind energy, put one of those things outside the state capitol, and it could power.
I'd like to watch it go round and round while I was working.
That's right.
Are there other questions?
That gentleman there, yes.
My name is Tim, and I'm wondering about the bridge, when the bridge will be built. What's holding it up to get approved?
What's holding it up? Well, eventually these steel girders will hold it up. I'll tell you what's holding it up. Primarily, there's only one thing. The federal government needs to appropriate $250 million for a customs plaza. A customs plaza because it's an international border crossing. Gary Peters, just before the election, told me that he was working very hard on Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnston. There's a prioritized list for these things. It may be there's a complication in that Republicans are not as keen on this, some of them, but if they don't approve it, what I'm pretty sure is going to happen is Canada will pay for it and bill us through the tolls they're going to collect.
Or they'll be like, oh, no.
To answer your question, the one thing that happened in that whole building process was they failed to get one thing before the governor decided to make that move back in 2012, was you can't build a bridge to another country without a presidential letter issuing the sanction. And essentially, they moved that bill and did it without the president or whatever department is governing it to say, it's good to go. So what they're doing right now is waiting on the federal paperwork.
No, they got the federal permit.
They did.
They got that. But they don't have the funding for the customs
plot. No, John Kerry...
Usually those letters come with the funding.
No, the Secretary of State, John Kerry, said, okay, it was actually one of the first things he did after he took over for Hillary Clinton. The issue is the $250 million that Americans apparently decided that Canada should give to us, even though they have already decided to give us, $1 billion to build this bridge. And Governor Snyder was like, no, we should take care of it.
Right. Secretary Clinton negotiated the deal, though.
And John Kerry wrote the letter and said, okay, he took the credit.
I've talked to some very high Canadian officials on this, and they are pissed off. They say, we've paid for 15/16 of this project that benefits you almost as much as us. You can at least build your own. They said Togo builds its own customs plaza.
They also chose to build it in a place that Matty Maroon owns a ton of property.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yes.
As a private citizen, Matty Maroon and his company bought a ton of property. So the bottom line is that probably a lot of this is the fact that this man owns a ton of the houses that need to be demolished to make that toll place happen. Now, whether you like him or not, and whether or not you agree with what he did or not, the fact of the matter is he's a property owner. He owns those properties that they need to put that footprint in to build that toll plaza.
In the Delray neighborhood? I thought there was all the land and everything like that. It was just fundamentally that they needed
it pretty much is acquired, and they could acquire what they need. I don't think that's a major problem
anymore. The land is a whole nother issue.
And they could invoke eminent domain for this.
Exactly, right. Which I think we'll probably likely see, which some lawmakers, Detroit lawmakers, Rashida Tlaib being one of them.
Eminent domain is a very interesting thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Somebody else.
Yeah.
Somebody who hasn't asked a question.
Hello, my name's Kara. Hi, an education student at Eastern Michigan. I luckily got a place for student teaching.
Yeah, I was going to say
last minute.
You're supposed to say long-time listener, first-time caller.
Love the show. Been listening for years.
She says you're hot.
What?
Anyways, I just want to know, are there going to be public schools for me to teach at in 10 years' time, or are they all going to be charter schools?
I would hope so, because I can't pay for private education.
Oh, there's look. There's absolutely going to be there's going to be public schools.
You don't want benefits or anything, do you, Carla? That's all good. Yes, there will be public
schools. There absolutely will be.
Okay, where else? All right, how about
here? That's George the question, Will, right?
Yeah. George Will from the Washington Post.
Speaking at MSU's commencement soon.
Exactly. With
it's really you.
Okay, you got my question. Any comments?
No, look, universities get to choose who they want to speak. Last year we saw the big hullabaloo over Condoleezza Rice speaking at a university. Some kids decided to protest. This is the decision universities make. George Will said, I think some unfortunate comments about some situations that are going on in the news right now. He's a columnist, though. He's allowed to say that. You know, is the school probably fundamentally wishing that this was not the news story right now? Absolutely. Producer Joe Lindstroth just sent me a story, though, yesterday about some students who are deciding to have a second commencement, you know, one that does not about George Will and having their own speaker. So, you know, we saw this when President Obama spoke at U of M in 2010. Was it their commencement? 2006, Bill Clinton was at U of M. We see some students that are really excited, some students that are protests. You know, that's how it works.
Well, the question is, well, you know, I'm the ombudsman for a paper that hired Ted Nugent to do a concert. So, but
it was actually, you know, Jack's idea.
I think the answer to that will be what the reaction is. What the reaction is after this happens. If you want my personal opinion, I think George Will is an absolute fraud and should have been boycotted, not because of what he had to say recently. In 1980, he coached Ronald Reagan in the presidential debate based on a stolen briefing book from the Carter people without telling people this, and then he went on television and commented on it and wrote columns rating their performance, which to me is fundamentally unethical.
Not it was a scandal.
This is what you should do every Sunday morning. Turn on This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
Right.
Decide on three facts. You won't know what they are. George Will has determined them. Three facts you never knew existed. He throws them out about every 8 minutes, and suddenly he sounds like he is God. And you start watching every Sunday, and you will get the formula, and you will get why some people love him and some people
don't. And I will journalism is a dying breed. There are a lot of folks that have not been around very long, and it's hard to come by a journalist that has that much experience. You may disagree with him. You may not like him. You may not like his opinion. But at the same time, he's been around long enough that if somebody wants to have him speak someplace, he has the right to do that. It's called free speech.
I think the issue is, though, that he said some remarks recently.
George Will is now on Fox News.
He's very good on baseball. Fine. He knows a lot about baseball.
But that's fine.
Free speech.
There's a gentleman jumping up and down back here.
Lou!
We had Lou already.
He already had a question. I'm going here. One question.
Hi, my name is Matthew. So I have my daughters here, so obviously my parenting choices are suspect at the best.
No, I think they're
what
right on.
What are their names?
Hi.
Lily and Alora.
Lily and what?
Lily and Alora.
How old is Lily?
How old is Lily?
Hello.
8 and 9.
You're famous.
8 and 9? I've got an 8-year-old. Hey.
So we keep hearing things about education, and I can say I'm sit down with my children every night. I look at the homework. They are literally years ahead of the work that I was doing at the same ages. At what point are we looking to the
parents?
Well,
what does that say about you?
Exactly. At what point are we looking at the parents and the environment and the pre-education instead of pointing the finger at the teachers? Why is it that this conversation has been looking only in that direction?
I think it's the best question of the night.
Lily, do you think your homework is too hard or is it okay?
She's too young for homework.
Fine.
Say that again?
I think it's perfectly fine.
Oh, snap, Dad. She thinks it's perfectly fine. Do you have to teach your dad some stuff when you're doing homework? Do you have to teach your dad some stuff? No, he helps you out.
I just want you to know that yesterday I went to my daughter. How old are you, Lily?
I'm 8.
She's the 8-year-old.
Oh, my daughter's 8. Has your dad ever blown off a volcano?
No.
Oh.
Work it, dude.
That's what his daughter got to do yesterday in class.
That's what we did yesterday.
Oh. Say that again. When do you get to explode it?
This weekend.
Yes!
Well, if I could make a comment away from pyromania, I think
no, it's vinegar and baking soda.
Let me
pyro. Baking soda.
It's pretty easy.
You were friends with Tim McVeigh, weren't you? I want to say something serious about this. I think that is the most serious question of the night. A couple of years ago, I knew a young couple, a guy and his fiancée. We were both teaching in charter schools in Detroit. And I took them out to lunch to talk about what they did. And the young woman said, how do you teach a child whose mother has a dubious occupation and the child lives in the back seat of her car while she performs this occupation, and he comes to school without enough to eat and no mental stimulation? I don't know that Thomas Dewey and every great educator in the country could reach that child. I don't know what you do about that, but I think you're absolutely right that making this all about teacher evaluations is not addressing a huge part of the problem.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy, and lawmakers, in fact, have some data that shows exactly that and have been unwilling to.
What's dubious mean?
Can you spell dubious, please? Can you use it in a sentence?
My dubious commentaries are aired.
Oh, we're hearing one more question.
I wanted someone who hasn't asked a question before.
Oh, I see it.
Way back there. Come on, go way back there. Go. Pass it way back.
Far to the left.
That's Livingston County, back.
Oh, now people are just throwing up their hands.
Go to Livingston County, yes.
Hi, I'm Evan, and I'm from Milford. Thanks for coming to our hometown.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Wahoo!
This place is lovely, by the way.
So my university decided this week to start wearing body cameras on their police officers.
City Ypsilanti?
My university, Eastern.
Oh, okay.
And Washtenaw County has done that as well. Do you think that's something that will move towards statewide or nationwide?
More than likely, yeah. I think the president's had a conversation about the fact that he wants to allocate some $700 million or some figure around that to see what they can do. But, I mean, they've got to do something for it because it's become an issue in the press, and that's what everybody's talking about. And so the natural trend in politics is to say, okay, we have to do something about that.
I'm wondering
if we're going to have to try it out and see what happens. Do I think it's going to fix the problem?
I don't think that's a political question.
No.
My only worry is how this will impact the ability of cops to eat donuts on the beat. I would like...
It's like they'll smear the
I'd like to ask my fellow panelists to applaud all of you for coming and listening to us tonight.
Thank you.
And Steve, you've got some remarks you want to...
I want to just thank you all for coming out tonight. Once again, let's have another round of applause for our panelists tonight who came out.
This is an amazing crowd.
Yes, we're so thankful you all came out tonight. Big thank you again to Ryan and all the great folks here at River's Edge Brewing and our wonderful staff and bartenders who are here. Make sure you tip your wait staff, tip your bartenders well. And thank you all for coming out. Don't forget, if you didn't fill out the entry form for the Paula Poundstone giveaway, you can still do that. Do you want to do it?
That's so fun to do it in front of
you. Do it now.
All right, there may be one issue. I may. The problem is I've got to find the key that unlocks the thing.
Wait.
See, this is why we don't normally do live spontaneous events like this. All right, hold on. Okay, we're going to do... All right. Here, Jack, just fill for a second here. Where? Back here?
Okay. What do I do?
Oh, all right. All right, hold on. We are going to do a drawing.
Oh, whoa. Stuff the ballot.
Stuff the ballot. All right. Last chance. Put your entry form in. Paula Poundstone tickets.